This is The Book and the Spade, a report on the latest discoveries and developments in biblical archaeology. Here's your host, Gordon Govier.
When I took half of a summer off in 1978 to travel to Israel to work on an archaeology project, I half thought I might change careers and become an archaeologist. Instead, I decided to stick with radio, but I still couldn't shake the archaeology bug and ultimately began this program. We're going to feature today the story of a man who traveled to Egypt in search of one thing and found something completely different, which ended up being his life's work. Egypt and Israel are inextricably linked in the story of the Bible and archaeology. Egyptology and biblical archaeology are two separate disciplines today, but our understanding of the biblical world has been shaped by the discoveries from ancient Egypt. So we're not going too far afield by presenting the story of Harvard University Egyptologist Mark Lehner. Mark, first of all, tell me how a young man from North Dakota found himself working in Egypt.
Well, I went over on a quest. It's a known skeleton in my closet that my interest in ancient Egypt started from a New Age kind of perspective. I was interested in the work of an alleged psychic named Edgar Cayce. And it was this information that prompted me to go over there as a year abroad student and investigate ancient Egypt and the pyramids and the Sphinx in the first place. While I was there, my belief system changed dramatically because of my encounter with bedrock reality. I became a fairly hardened skeptic about most belief systems, actually. And yet that's what fueled my passion for archaeology, where you can dig things up that you can break your teeth on, and you either have an ancient bakery or you don't, you know, solid kind of evidence on which to base ideas and reconstructions about the past.
Is the Sphinx carved out of bedrock, or is it built on top of it?
No, the Sphinx is carved right out of the natural rock of the Giza Plateau. It's limestone. It's clad around the bottom, though, with a casing, repair masonry that's been added at various different ancient periods.
Is it about the same age as the pyramids or older?
No, the Sphinx is about the same age as the pyramids, about 4,500 years, to the best of the evidence that we have. And that would put the Sphinx in the fourth dynasty out of 30 dynasties, you know, generally comprising 3,000 years of ancient Egyptian history. The Sphinx belongs to the Old Kingdom, the first third of Egyptian history, ancient Egyptian history, about 2,500 B.C.
So you found it difficult to tear yourself away, and you stayed there and got involved in archaeology.
That's right.
Tell me a little bit more how that developed.
Well, as I was in Egypt as a year abroad student, I spent every waking moment I could out at the Giza Plateau in the middle of the night. That's before we had so many security concerns. The plateau and the site was more accessible and open. In general, my passion for archaeology at Giza was fueled by the idea that, well, my preconceived ideas don't stack up against bedrock reality, so, you know, what is the story that the site itself tells? Rather than my expectations, you know, what does the actual physical evidence give me? And I think this is a very common encounter, not just for archaeologists, but for scientists and actually people everywhere, where our expectations and our beliefs don't necessarily match up to, you know, our physical life experience.
And you found that you had a skill for drafting, and that gave you a job.
Yeah, I loved nothing more than actually freezing an ancient situation, freshly exposed, with a line drawing. Of course, we also, as archaeologists, do it in photographs and text. You know, we write descriptions of what we see. That was particularly satisfying, and I fell in love with the techniques of surveying, architectural drawing, and general recording in archaeology. And I guess because I had a good hand and I didn't need an airline ticket, I was able to join, you know, many different missions. French, German, English, some Egyptian, some American, and so spent 13 years in Egypt before going back to pursue this career in graduate study.
And you were able to make enough to support yourself then with those different jobs?
Yeah, not a whole lot, but we patched it together in a kind of freelancing situation. Part of those 13 years, though, I was already directing my own project and raising some of my own funds, you know, to map the Great Sphinx, and that led to a wider project to map the entire Giza Pyramids Plateau.
Mm-hmm. Mapping the entire Giza Plateau upon which sits the Sphinx and the Great Pyramids became the life's work of Mark Lehner, a Harvard University Egyptologist who is our guest on The Book and the Spade. Quite a daunting challenge.
Well, I suppose, but Egypt is kind of like that. You know, people can go like the Frenchman Auguste Mariette, who went in 1850 to buy Coptic manuscripts for the Louvre, and he ended up being, you know, the czar of all archaeology in Egypt for a number of decades. Egypt is amenable to people who want to do research, to do archaeology.
Well, we think about all of the explorers and all the archaeologists who have worked there in the 200 years since the Rosetta Stone was found and the flood began, and you might think that most of the archaeology that could be done has been done, but that's obviously not the case. There was still a lot more for you to do at the Giza Plateau.
Well, there was, yes, and there wasn't. Since Egypt was opened up for excavation and exploration on the part of, you know, foreign missions, many great sites have been excavated. You know, the great Karnak Temple, the Valley of the Kings, probably most of the royal tombs are discovered, the royal tombs of the first dynasty at Saqqara. What was there to do in the case of Giza was the recording, such as we just talked about. When I started working at Giza in 1977, there were no scale drawings of the Great Sphinx. When we excavate a square, you know, at a site like Megiddo or Tel Dan or any site anywhere in the Near East, you know, the first thing you do when you expose, you know, a fresh surface, say an Iron Age house, you know, the ruins of it, is you map it in great detail in a line drawing. So we take such great care when we excavate any kind of site these days, but that had never been done for the Great Sphinx, and it still hasn't actually been done for the Giza Pyramids. So that when people think about building the pyramids, basically they're dealing more with a mental template than the fabric of the pyramids itself, the archaeological reality in front of them. So that was like shooting fish in a barrel, as far as looking for something to do and something to contribute at Giza. The site had never actually been properly mapped and studied as an archaeological site. It had been studied more like an outdoor museum, like an art and architecture site. So my first task that I took on, with the help of the American Research Center in Egypt, was produce scale drawings of the Great Sphinx.
And at the same time, or roughly that time, you needed to get more training and schooling, so you went back to school?
Well, after 13 years, like I say, I worked on a number of different missions and had my own project going at Giza, and then I went back to Yale University for a PhD in 1986 with the help of William Kelly Simpson, who is the professor of Egyptology at Yale. I was already 36, but I realized that I had to get my degree and get some training that I lacked if I'm going to capitalize on what I had devoted, you know, basically the years of young adulthood to, which is archaeology in Egypt.
And in the back of your mind during this time was, I guess, what's been kind of called the Dream Project, which was trying to find the remains left behind of the people who built the pyramids?
Yeah, that Dream Project kind of grew over a number of years as I worked at Giza. First, my focus was like other archaeologists, in a sense, namely on the larger structures, you know, the mastaba, the tombs, the large tombs, the temples, the pyramids themselves. Originally, I was focused on the Great Sphinx.
Our guest on today's program is Harvard University Egyptologist Mark Lehner, who, like many people, was attracted to the large structures that dominate the Giza Plateau, but found a new direction to focus his research.
Well, I started working at the Sphinx, and my focus was therefore on one of the large structures, like so much archaeology that had gone before, you know, focusing on temples, pyramids, tombs, in my case, the Sphinx. But a project to map the Sphinx drew my attention to the overall geology of the Giza Plateau, because the Sphinx is made right out of the natural rock and contains many of the layers of the Giza Plateau, the same layers that the Egyptians used for quarrying stone for the pyramids. And there are two temples in front of the Sphinx, one for the Sphinx itself, and one is the Valley Temple connected to the second pyramid by a long causeway, as every pyramid has a Valley Temple. It seemed to the geologists working with me and myself that these temples and the Sphinx were created in the same quarry construction process. They took stone away from the quarry, leaving a core that became the Great Sphinx, and they moved the stone to the front for building these two temples.
So in our mind's eye, we could unbuild the temples and put the stone back in the quarry with our surveying and the geologist's input and so on. Then it was a question, well, could we do this with the whole Giza Plateau? Because to the south of the pyramids, there are these huge quarries where they've taken clearly many of the stones for the pyramids. We began the Giza Plateau mapping project with the aim to document the landscape and the stories about pyramid building that the landscape had to offer. You know, the volume of stone missing from the quarries, comparing it to the stone in the pyramids. Other things then started falling into line, like if the quarries are down here to the south-southeast part of the Giza Plateau, then the ramps have to go from the quarries up to the pyramid. Then that led to a number of other big features that should be out there and we should be able to locate. If we have the pyramid, the ramp, the quarry, then we should expect somewhere beyond the quarries a harbor where the Egyptians could have brought the granite from Aswan 500 miles to the south, or the finer limestone from across the river on the eastern bank quarries for the casing of the pyramids. So if we have pyramid, ramp, quarry, and a harbor, logically the infrastructure for all the people who were there building the pyramid should lie just beyond to the south-southeast. And that's when my curiosity started to grow. Well, where are all these people? Herodotus, the Greek father of history, who was in Egypt around 1450 BC, said that there were 100,000 people building the pyramids. Well, he might have meant that they were working in shifts. I mean, he was there 2,000 years after the pyramids were built. But even sober Egyptologists estimated you might have numbers of 20, 30,000 people. My studies of archaeology in areas like southern Mesopotamia and Iran, Iraq, you know, ancient Sumer and Elam, suggested that if you have 20 or 30,000 people in one place, it would be basically one of the largest cities in the world in the early 3rd millennium B.C. Because I was studying the work of Robert McCormick Adams, for example, who surveyed the large tells in southern Iraq, the locations of ancient cities like Uruk, you know, Erech of the Bible.
So there should have been some evidence of these cities that nobody had ever noticed.
Well, you would think, because, for example, in the case of Erech or Uruk, the tell, I think, covers more than 400 hectares. And Robert McCormick Adams estimated, you know, something like 100 to 150 people per hectare. A hectare is 10,000 square meters. So you'd have 50,000 people out there at some point. My problem was just the opposite. Instead of the problem of those archaeologists who find an ancient tell and try to understand how many people lived there at a given period based on the ceramics and so on, my problem was, well, it's estimated that we had 20 or 30,000 people out here, so where's the site?
Because if you convert hectares to acres, the city Mark Lehner is talking about should have been anywhere from 500 to 750 acres. One hectare is just under 2.5 acres.
This 2004 interview with Mark Lehner continued on, and we'll pick it up in our next program. In the meantime, a reminder, you can find more information on our Biblical Archaeology News magazine, Artifacts, at our website, radioscribe.com. There you'll also find information on upcoming archaeological study tours to Israel and breaking news videos from the Israel Antiquities Authority. That's at radioscribe.com. I'm Gordon Govier. Thanks for joining us. Tune in again next time for more Backgrounders on the Bible through Biblical Archaeology on The Book and the Spade.
The Book and the Spade is produced by Scribe Media. For information on Biblical Archaeology resources or obtaining a copy of this program on CD, go to our website at radioscribe.com.